This is Chuck Kaufman, your volunteer reader in Flagstaff, bringing you the Tuesday edition of the Wall Street Journal. It's the 2nd of December, and we have these headlines from the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Second strike on boat draws deeper scrutiny of Hang Seng. Crypto sell-off worsens in retreat from risk. And questions about NATO's future, Royal Europe. Starting with that first headline, second strike on boat draws deeper scrutiny of Hang Seng. Pentagon chief authorized attack that killed survivors. He cites admiral's role. This article is by Michael R. Gordon, Lindsay Wise, and Shelby Holliday. Washington. The White House said Monday that the U.S. military conducted two strikes on a boat in the Caribbean in September, deepening questions about Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's role in an operation that led to the killing of two survivors. Admiral Frank Mitch Bradley, the head of Special Operations Command, was acting legally under authority to use lethal force granted by Hegseth in conducting multiple attacks on the boat, White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said. The White House defense of Hang Seng came in response to a report in the Washington Post on Friday that he gave a spoken order to kill them all aboard the vessel. The first strike killed all but two of the 11 occupants before Bradley ordered a second missile strike, which killed the men, according to the Post. A Defense Department official on Monday provided a similar account to the Wall Street Journal and said Hang Seng was the target engagement authority, the key figure who authorized the strike. President Trump said Sunday that Hang Seng told him that he didn't issue an order to kill all the people on board. Pete said he did not order the death of those two men, Trump told reporter, during a flight to Washington from Florida. And I believe him. But Trump later added, I wouldn't have wanted that, in response to questions about whether he favored targeting survivors. Monday evening, Hang Seng wrote in a social media post that the September 2nd attacks were Bradley's decisions. To make one thing crystal clear, Admiral Mitch Bradley is an American hero, a true professional, and has my 100% support, Hang Seng wrote. I stand by him and the combat decisions he's made on the September 2nd mission and all others since. Leavitt said in a statement to read to reporters at the White House that Bradley had directed the attacks. On September 2nd, Secretary Hang Seng authorized Admiral Bradley to conduct these kinetic strikes, she said. Admiral Bradley worked well within his authority and the law directing the engagement to ensure the boat was destroyed and the threat to the United States of America was eliminated. Bradley didn't respond to a request for comment. A day after the strike, Hang Seng said he'd monitored it as it occurred and expressed no misgivings on how it had been carried out. I watched the strike live, he said, in a September 3 appearance on Fox News. We knew exactly who it was, exactly what they were doing, exactly where they were going, what they were involved in. Brian Finucane, a former legal advisor to the State Department during the Obama administration and first Trump administration, said an order to give no quarter to the targets of an attack would violate the Defense Department's rules on use of force. The Pentagon's Law of War manual also bars attacks on shipwrecks where alleged combatants are unable to fight, Finucane said. Representative Adam Smith of Washington, the top-ranking Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee, said that Congress is probing the episode, and Bradley is expected to brief the chairs and ranking members of the Senate and House Armed Services Committees in a classified session this week. We want to know what happened, what are the orders, what are the rules of engagement, how does this fit with the legality, and we want to go up the chain of command, Smith said. Secretary Hang Seng made a big point of saying he was running these operations, so ultimately he's the one who ought to come in and explain it to us. Lawmakers from both parties expressed concern over the attack. If there's a second strike and everything, that seems way over the edge to me, said Senator Jim Justice, Republican of West Virginia. I don't see how that is acceptable, to tell you the truth. Senator Roger Wicker, the Mississippi Republican, who chairs the Armed Services Committee, said on Monday night that he's planning vigorous oversight of those allegations. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, said in a speech on the Senate floor Monday, Secretary Hang Seng loves to look tough. He loves to boast about the lethality of our forces. He wants to be taken seriously, but yesterday he posted a ridiculous tweet of a cartoon turtle firing on alleged drug traffickers, a sick parody of a well-known children's book. Even before Hegseth's role in the September attack became public, there was intense debate about the legality of the boat strikes in the Caribbean Sea and Eastern Pacific Ocean, which have killed more than 80 people. The White House has said that it is targeting narco-terrorists and that military force is lawful under Trump's authority as commander-in-chief. Some lawmakers and former military legal officers say that the strikes are illegal because the targets are civilians who are smuggling drugs for profit and aren't an enemy group seeking to attack the U.S. Pentagon spokesman didn't respond Monday to requests for comment. On Sunday, Hegseth responded to criticism of the boat strikes in a social media message in which he showed the cartoon character Franklin the Turtle blasting boats operated by narco-terrorists. The debate over the strikes is the latest controversy to engulf Hegseth, who in February fired the top lawyers from the military services, saying they were not well suited and could be potential roadblocks to orders given by a commander-in-chief. Critics said the move would remove those experienced in applying the law of war and who provide independent legal advice on the use of force. Hegseth stirred more debate in September when he summoned top military commanders to Quantico, Virginia for a speech in which he argued that the military should not be bound by politically correct rules of engagement. "We're training warriors, not defenders," he said. "We also don't fight with stupid rules of engagement. We untie the hands of our warfighters to intimidate, demoralize, hunt, and kill the enemies of our country." And that second strike on boat draws deeper scrutiny of Hegseth. Our next headline, crypto sell-off worsens in retreat from risk. Bitcoin dropped 6% as investors feeling economic unease unwind exposure. This is by Vicky Gi Huang. The rout in cryptocurrency is intensifying. Bitcoin's tumbled more than 6% on Monday, its biggest one-day drop since March. The world's largest digital currency traded at $85,468 as of 4 p.m. Eastern Time and is down more than 30% from a peak above $126,000 set in early October. The sell-off has spilled into other digital coins, including other Ether and Solana, and pulled down stocks tied to the crypto market, such as exchange operator Coinbase Global and Strategy, Michael Saylor's Bitcoin accumulation company. Bitcoin and other digital tokens have been caught up in a broader decline, afflicting riskier trades across all markets. Unprofitable technology businesses, speculative shell companies, and meme stocks have all fallen out of favor in recent months. Investors are dialing down their risk exposure as they turn more pessimistic about the market and the economy, said Patrick Horsman, chief investment officer at crypto treasury firm BNB Plus. "I think we could see Bitcoin get all the way back to $60,000, Horsman said of Bitcoin. "We don't think the pain is over." Powerful rallies and stomach-churning downturns have been a part of the crypto industry since its earliest days. In previous crypto winters, Bitcoin and other prominent digital assets lost as much as 80% of their value before turning around. Each of the previous cycles, including the 2022 winter, was triggered in part by investors' concerns for widespread fraud. The absence of a new Mt. Gox or FTX crypto businesses whose implosions help trigger broader market crashes is what makes the current sell-off reassuring to some and harder to explain to others. Saylor Strategy, the software company that pioneered the practice of selling corporate debt and stock to buy Bitcoin, unveiled plans Monday that seemed to suggest a chill was in the air. Strategy said it raised $1.44 billion through a stock sale to help ensure it can meet future dividend and debt interest payments. The reserve should fund 12 to 24 months of its preferred stock dividends. The company said it also bought 130 Bitcoin in the past 2 weeks, bringing its total holding to 655,000, worth about $56 billion based on current prices. Overshadowing that news, though, were comments Saylor made during a video presentation in which he said it was possible his company would sell some of its Bitcoin and related securities if its market cap trades below the net asset value of its Bitcoin holdings, a metric the industry has coined as MNAV. "We would do that because it's in the best interest of the shareholders," he said. Saylor's comments came days after Strategy CEO Phong Le said in a podcast that the company could sell some of its Bitcoin holdings as a last resort. Le said the company would sell Bitcoin to fund its dividend payments if its MNAV falls below 1 and loses access to other forms of capital. "Now, as we are looking at Bitcoin winter, we see our MNAV compressing. My hope is our MNAV doesn't go below 1, he said. "But if we do and we didn't have other access to capital, we would sell Bitcoin." Strategy shares, which had lost nearly half their value this year, fell as much as 12% on Monday before paring losses. Shares closed down more than 3% to $171.42 on Monday. Ether fell 7.6% on Monday and has dropped 17% this year. Solana, another prominent digital token, lost about 8%. Coinbase Global, which operates the largest U.S. crypto exchange, fell 4.8%. Circle Internet Group, which issues a U.S. dollar-pegged stablecoin, dropped 5%. Other crypto treasury companies also fell. Share of Ether stockpiling company Bitmine Immersion Technologies dropped 13%, and Solana accumulation company Forward Industries declined 12%. And that's crypto sell-off worsens in retreat from risk. Our next article is by Bertrand Benoit and David Lunau. Questions about NATO's future, Royal Europe, Berlin. This week will bring a split screen that will reinforce growing doubts in Europe about the U.S. commitment to the alliance that has served as the bedrock of Western unity since the end of World War II. On one side, White House Special Envoy Steve Witkoff will be in Moscow for the latest round of peace talks with the Kremlin over the Ukraine war. Witkoff, who has yet to visit Ukraine, is making his sixth trip to Moscow this year. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Marco Rubio will be skipping a biannual gathering of NATO foreign ministers and sending a deputy in his place. The last time the U.S.'s top diplomat didn't show up at the event was 1999, when Washington's focus was on Middle East peace, said a former NATO spokeswoman. His absence will be felt acutely, coming as it does in the middle of talks over ending the Ukraine war that have prompted many European leaders to question whether Washington's priorities are still aligned with those of Europe. A leaked plan and transcripts of a call between Witkoff and a top Kremlin foreign policy aide have left many with the impression that the Trump administration is more interested in improving ties and economic cooperation with Russia than defending the transatlantic alliance. Two aspects of the 28-point peace plan in particular landed like bombshells in Europe's defense and foreign policy establishment. First, the plan treated Russia as a clear winner and Ukraine as the loser, forcing Kyiv to give up strategic land it hasn't lost, shrink its military, and leave it without a guarantee of protection from either the U.S. or European allies should Russia rearm and come back for more. Second, it described the U.S. as a mediator between Russia and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, suggesting the U.S. no longer saw itself as a member of the alliance it has long dominated. It is a Versailles Treaty, except one that punishes the victim and rewards the aggressor, said Carlo Massala, professor of international politics at the Bundeswehr University, München, referring to the treaty that ended World War I. And I think it reflects the positions of a certain faction in the U.S. government. The Europeans have had some success pushing back on the terms of a possible peace deal. Witkoff will be presenting amended terms of the plan to Russian President Vladimir Putin this week. Some European diplomats also recognize that the Trump administration's biggest goal is to end the fighting. But skepticism in Europe has deepened as more information has emerged about how the U.S. plan was drafted, including a leaked call in which Witkoff appeared to be coaching Yuri Ushakov, a Kremlin foreign policy advisor, on what Putin should say to President Trump, according to a transcript published by Bloomberg News. That's the dream scenario for Russia since the Soviet Union. Its goal has been to get a wedge between the U.S. and Europe, said retired U.S. Army Lieutenant General Ben Hodges. I think the reason Trump disregards Europe is because he sees Europe as being inconsequential. The White House hasn't disputed the veracity of the report of the leaked call and has defended Witkoff. Polish Premier Donald Tusk called the draft plan unacceptable. Former Finnish Foreign Minister Pekka Haavisto said it was a pity that NATO partners needed to learn about the details of peace plans involving Ukraine from media reports. This shows that, as a political entity, NATO has not been working properly, he said. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky met with French President Emmanuel Macron on Monday and later spoke to Trump, underscoring the importance of security guarantees for Ukraine, Macron's office said. If it weren't for the Europeans, a French official said earlier, Putin and Trump would have reached an agreement a long time ago. Europe, the official said, finds itself alone because the Americans are disengaging with the region. The Americans and Europeans are coming at the peace process from two different angles, said Emily Ferris, a Russia expert at the Royal United Services Institute, a London think tank specializing in defense and military affairs. Europe sees Russia rearming and is worried about the next war, she said. The Americans are thinking much more short term. Let's get this process over the line, ceasefire deal, get Ukraine back on its feet, and cobble together some sort of cold peace for another year or two. Most European political and military leaders agree that Putin's ambition is to rebuild Russia's imperial reach. Standing in his way is NATO and its mutual defense clause, which states that an attack on one is an attack on all members. Putin knows he can't defeat NATO in a head-on fight, especially given how badly the war in Ukraine has gone for Russian forces. His only hope is to defeat it politically by undermining its cohesiveness, said Ed Arnold, a former British Army infantry officer who specializes in European security analysis for the RUSI think tank. The U.S.'s latest peace plan would go a long way toward dividing NATO by proposing what would amount to an amnesty for Russia for the invasion, allowing it to re-enter the G8 club of rich countries and pursue joint economic development plans with the U.S. in areas like the Arctic. That would create huge divisions within the transatlantic partnership, Arnold said. Politically, Russia is on the cusp of winning. That's questions about NATO's future Royal Europe. Next, we have car buyers balk after years of prices going up. This is by Sharon Turlip. For years, it seemed no sticker price was too high for American car buyers. Even as average new car prices approached $50,000 this year, dealers fretted more over depleted inventories than losing customers to sticker shock. Those days are coming to an end. Increasingly stretched consumers are starting to draw the line on what they'll pay for a new car, according to dealers, analysts, and industry data. Car buyers are downsizing, buying used vehicles, taking on longer car loans, and holding out for deals. People are asking, how can I afford this? Said Robert Peltier, who owns dealerships in East Texas. He said traffic, while still solid, has slowed at his dealerships and more customers are gravitating toward less costly cars such as the pint-size Chevrolet Trax. There are people who are in debt and living paycheck to paycheck, he said. For the U.S. auto industry, 2025 was supposed to be a banner year, fueled by tax cuts and a deregulatory wave. Some analysts predicted a third straight annual sales increase as automakers, which had been hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic and semiconductor shortages, finally got their factories running at full steam. Now forecasts predict muted or no growth for the year and more of the same in 2026. The industry had reason for optimism. Car prices soared because of short supply post-COVID, and consumers remained willing to pay up even as inventory came back and volumes approached historic norms. Car buyers continued to shrug off higher prices earlier this year, even as they pared back shopping for everything from dishwashers to beer. But now, auto tariffs, persistent inflation, and a tighter job market have more Americans rethinking their biggest ticket purchases. Meanwhile, the collapse of the U.S. electric vehicle market, hastened by the end of the federal government's $7,500 EV credit in September, has cost the industry hundreds of thousands of potential vehicle sales. With a surge in EV demand before the credit expired, auto sales kept ahead of pace through three quarters as automakers with large North American footprints flexed their ability to produce and absorb the tariff burden. General Motors sales jumped 10.5% and Ford's rose 7.3%. But then October's selling rate was the slowest in more than a year. November results announced this week are expected to be down, and a quick rebound isn't in the forecast. Signs of strain are beginning to show up in the data. Cars are sitting longer on dealer lots. Dealers are piling on extra discounts to make sales. Lower-income borrowers are defaulting on car loans. Americans, as a whole, are spending less overall on vehicle purchases than they did a year ago. Other components of the economy are tugging on the consumer, said Ivan Drury, an automotive analyst for the car shopping website Edmunds.com. That tension is unlikely to lead to dramatic price cuts or plummeting sales, some analysts and economists said. That's because years of tight new car supply means used cars, even older ones, are historically pricey as well. And many car owners are reaching the limit of how long they can hold out for a new vehicle. The cost of car parts and repairs has climbed too, so hanging on to old vehicles comes with its own costs. You can't really find relief, Drury said. The reality is evident in the showroom. Several of the industry's biggest auto retailers reported weaker margins and profits on new vehicle sales in the most recent quarter. Something's got to give, and it's typically the dealer that will have to put more money on the hood to move the vehicle, said Aaron Keating, an executive analyst at the services firm Cox Automotive. She said she expects U.S. vehicle sales to continue to climb, albeit more slowly. Not all shoppers are suffering. A swath of the nation's consumers have continued to amass wealth and are bolstering industry profits as they pay top dollar for trucks and sport utility vehicles loaded with heated steering wheels and massaging seats. Still, there are only so many Americans on the upward leg of the K-shaped economy. There are going to be a few more alarm bells out there saying we really are relying on the top 20% of households to sustain the market, Keating said. Michael Sassano, who manages a Chevrolet dealership in New Rochelle, New York, took in the latest data on visits to the store's websites and physical showroom. Traffic was down for both. Less price-conscious consumers have already purchased their cars, and now he's seeing more people who've held out for years because they're loath to take on higher car payments. More customers aren't just willing to pull the trigger, he said. They say, wow, I'm paying $500 a month now. I don't want to pay $700. The good news, he said, businesses up on the service side of the shop as people try to squeeze more life out of their cars. Patriot Scudo, a 35-year-old from Idaho, needed a new car after his older Acura was totaled in an accident. He and his wife have a newer Tesla, but wanted a reliable and reasonably spacious second car that could hold up on long road trips. Even though the couple is financially secure, she is a doctor, he stays home. Scudo followed with dread the news reports about ever-climbing vehicle prices, and he approached the car buying process ready to do battle. He looked at a Hyundai early on, but was thrown by the price. I was flabbergasted. For a week, the pair price shopped a dozen dealers negotiating across several states. As the days wore on, Zudo said, dealers who once balked at matching his best offer called back and said they could do better. They were all calling us, asking, what do we need to do to get your business, he said. The couple eventually settled on a higher-end Hyundai Tucson hybrid. The dealer knocked some $5,000 off the initial asking price. That's car buyers' balk after years of prices going up. Let's turn to the opinion page of the Wall Street Journal for this item by the Wall Street Journal editorial board. Two tangled cases at the Supreme Court. The law can be a maze for Americans trying to vindicate their rights, but at the end is supposed to be an exit leading to justice. Two cases at the Supreme Court this week are examples of how procedures and precedents can trap citizens inside a legal labyrinth. The petitioner on Tuesday is First Choice, which runs five pro-life pregnancy centers. The faith-based nonprofit offers free ultrasounds and other support, but not abortions. New Jersey Attorney General Matthew Platkin wants to investigate whether people who gave money were misled on that last point. Without identifying a single donor complaint, First Choice says the AG demanded to see names and phone numbers for some 5,000 donations. He said he needed donor names and contact information so that he could contact a representative sample and determine what they did or did not know about their charitable giving. The nonprofit recounts in First Choice versus Platkin. Mr. Platkin's subpoena has chilled its rights under the First Amendment, it argues. The Supreme Court has long upheld donor privacy, going back to NAACP versus Alabama, 1958. But federal judges say First Choice's constitutional rights aren't a ripe question as the state subpoena process grinds forward. Any risk that donors' identities will be produced is speculative and remains wholly contingent on a future state court order requiring production, Mr. Platkin's brief says. So far, the state court has repeatedly declined, instead telling the state to negotiate, leading it to agree to narrow the subpoena to seek donor information only from two websites. Yet, if an AG makes an unconstitutional demand, it'd be good to have a federal court say so early before the target spends years in state court. First Choice says it suffered an injury the moment the Attorney General issued the subpoena. On Wednesday, it's Gabriel Oliver's turn at the high court. A street preacher in Brandon, Mississippi, Mr. Oliver was fined $304 for violating an ordinance restricting protests near a city amphitheater. Now he wants to challenge the prospective constitutionality of that rule, but his claim was rejected by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals under a 1994 precedent that disallows using such lawsuits to collaterally attack criminal convictions. As Mr. Oliver's brief explains it, the 1994 High Court ruling, Heck versus Humphrey, stands for the ideal that if a prisoner seeks damages for confinement imposed pursuant to legal process, a federal court judgment would be incompatible with an undisturbed state court conviction. This makes sense in the original legal context, though in Oliver versus the City of Brandon, it's perplexing. Because Mr. Oliver was fined for breaking the ordinance in the past, he's barred from asking a judge to protect him in the future. Can that be correct? If he can't go to court, Mr. Olivier might feel little choice but to forego First Amendment activity that he thinks is protected, or would he feel forced to create a new legal challenge by breaking the law again, risking more punishment? The full Fifth Circuit declined an en banc review of its ruling, but the vote was 9-8, and the dissenters said applying Heck this way is indefensible. Legal rights are only as good as the ability to vindicate them. Now, it's up to the justices. And that's two tangled court cases at the Supreme Court. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. You can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming either as it streams or at a time of your choosing, by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website, that's available at sunsounds.org, or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, available for your Apple iPhone or iPad from the Apple App Store, or from the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And you can always listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona as it streams on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show. Turn now to the business and finance section of the Wall Street Journal for these headlines. Disney's CEO drama nears finale. Prospect of Japan rate rise rattles investors. and Netflix sweetens bid for Warner Discovery. That first article is by Ben Fritz, Isabella Simonetti, and Joe Flint. Disney CEO drama nears finale. Parks chief D'Amato and television head Walden considered leading contenders. Disney's past attempts to pick a successor to CEO Bob Iger have been less than magical. Now the company is trying to write a happier ending. Iger, who succeeded Michael Eisner in 2025 following a shareholder revolt, has postponed planned retirement dates 5 times and helped push out a number of top executives poised to succeed him. Veteran insider Bob Chapek became CEO in 2020, only to be succeeded by Iger himself in a dramatic 2022 corporate coup. Disney's board has said it would announce in early 2026 its pick to succeed Iger. The company is widely expected to promote from within, with Parks chief Josh D'Amaro and television head Dana Walden considered the leading contenders by employees and people who work with Disney. The two executives met with Disney's board this summer in Orlando, Florida, to discuss their visions for the company should they become CEO, according to people with knowledge of the meeting. Whoever is named as the next CEO is expected to work alongside Iger for a while to learn the ropes before officially taking over, a person familiar with the board's thinking said. Iger's contract expires next December. One of the board's top priorities for the current succession process is to ensure there is as little drama surrounding it as possible, with no major exits or brain drain when the new CEO is picked, according to people familiar with the matter. The company recently extended the contracts of its general counsel, chief financial officer, and heads of communications and human resources so they end between 2027 and 2029, according to public disclosures. Disney has also had contract extension talks with other top executives who report to Iger, including the people who operate key business units, one of the people familiar with the matter said. The board itself has been tight-lipped. I think the best the board can do is run a really thorough process so that in the end, when a decision gets made, people feel very good that we have done our homework, board member Caroline Everson said at a Wall Street Journal Leadership Institute event in November. D'Amaro, who chairs Disney's Experiences Unit that includes theme parks, consumer products, cruise ships, and video games, is widely considered the leading contender to be the next CEO. His strongest rival is Walden, a veteran television executive who is co-chair of Disney Entertainment, which includes streaming. Supporters of D'Amaro said he is analytical, comfortable talking to Hollywood talent who have collaborated with the parks, and a charismatic public ambassador for the brand. Theme parks have become Disney's most important businesses in recent years, as traditional television has faltered and streaming isn't nearly as profitable as TV networks once were. D'Amaro has overseen numerous price increases at the parks while remaining popular with fans. D'Amaro's vision for Disney includes giving video games a bigger role and integrating gaming technology throughout its creative processes, a person familiar with his thinking said. The Experiences boss, who has been with Disney since 1998, championed a $1.5 billion investment in Epic Games last year and has overseen the relationship with the Fortnite maker. Walden is less of a Disney native, having joined it when it acquired the entertainment assets of 21st Century Fox in 2019. But her backers say she is the company's most experienced and accomplished creative executive. Hit film and TV content, they say, is the engine that powers all of Disney's businesses. She shares oversight of streaming and helped manage that business's improving profit margins. She also has experience managing some of the company's most delicate and important commercial and creative relationships, from the recent carriage dispute with YouTube TV to September's benching and reinstatement of late-night host Jimmy Kimmel. Veteran film executive Alan Bergman, who runs streaming with Walden and oversees brands such as Pixar, Lucasfilm, and Avatar, and is considered unlikely to succeed Iger by employees and company partners. ESPN head Jimmy Pitaro, Disney's other top operating executive, has expressed he is in his dream job and doesn't expect to become CEO, given his lack of experience in scripted entertainment and parks, people with knowledge of the matter said. His contract has multiple years left on it, one of the people said. Many employees have aligned behind the scenes with D'Amaro or Walden, but no candidate wants to be seen as engaging in politicking, people close to the company said. Even so, every move and public appearance by senior executives is interpreted through the lens of how they may be positioning themselves for a post-Iger world. Disney's board has considered outside candidates, including video game company Electronic Arts chief Andrew Wilson, the Wall Street Journal previously reported. But people close to Disney believe an internal executive will probably be promoted to CEO. The board hasn't said whether it might consider appointing co-CEOs. Disney has never had multiple leaders before, though it has at times had a CEO working alongside a powerful deputy, another possibility in the post-Iger configuration. Whoever takes over will face many challenges, including managing a $60 billion expansion of theme parks, growing a collection of streaming services that face intense competition, and re-energizing key movie brands such as Marvel. They will also have to contend with continued cord-cutting that has weighed on the legacy TV business at Disney and its rivals. Disney Board Chair James Gorman is leading the CEO selection process. When the board picked Chapek in 2020, Iger was chairman. Gorman was widely praised for managing a CEO transition at Morgan Stanley that, like Disney, featured internal candidates jockeying for the position. And that's Disney's CEO drama nears finale. Next, we have prospect of Japan rate rise rattles investors. This is by Sam Goldfarb. U.S. markets are facing a threat from across the Pacific. Yields on government debt, which rise when the prices of those bonds fall, climbed around the world on Monday after the Bank of Japan governor hinted at a potential interest rate increase later this month, surprising investors who thought he might hold off under possible pressure from the country's new prime minister. The comments from BOJ Governor Kazuo Ueda pushed the yield on Japan's 10-year government bond to 1.879%, its highest closing level since June 2008, according to Dow Jones market data. The yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury note also climbed, settling at 4.095% from just below 4% in the middle of last week. Some on Wall Street worry that rising bond yields in Japan will draw cash away from U.S. investments and spark a climb in Treasury yields, which play a key role in determining borrowing costs for consumers and businesses. The world's third largest economy is the U.S. government's largest foreign creditor, according to Treasury Department data, holding Treasuries valued at about $1.2 trillion as of September. Private Japanese investors poured hundreds of billions of dollars into U.S. and other foreign bonds in recent years, seeking better returns than they could find at home. For most of this year, that dynamic hasn't played out. Japanese bond yields have climbed as investors there prepared for higher rates. Yields on treasuries, meanwhile, have fallen as the Federal Reserve moves in the opposite direction. Still, analysts warn that there could be limits to that divergence. You'd seen a lot of comfort with the idea that U.S. yields are just moving lower in this predetermined path, said Zach Griffiths, head of investment grade and macro strategy at the research firm CreditSights. Today is a reminder that there are a lot of factors that could challenge that. Investors and economists pay close attention to U.S. Treasury yields because they play a critical role in determining borrowing costs across the economy, along with the prices of a range of financial assets. Treasury yields have declined this year thanks in large part to a cooling labor market, which has pushed the Fed to start cutting interest rates again. That, in turn, has helped lower mortgage rates and boost stocks, which tend to benefit from lower yields because investors can no longer get as much risk-free return from simply holding treasuries to maturity. U.S. stocks fell Monday. The S&P 500 dropped 0.5%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 0.9%, or around 427 points, and the NASDAQ Composite gave up 0.4%. This year, though, the S&P 500 is up 16%, even managing to eke out a gain last month despite growing concerns about lofty tech stock valuations. Some investors believe that stocks are now in an even better position after their early November losses, arguing that indexes have been due for a pullback after months of steady gains. It's always healthy to get some air let out of the balloon, said Nancy Tengler, Chief Investment Officer at Laffer Tengler Investments. In recent months, many investors have grown hopeful that the U.S. economy is in an almost perfect position for stocks and bonds to keep rallying. Soft enough to support further interest rate cuts, but not so weak as to generate recession fears. The Fed has cut rates at each of its past two meetings. Just a few weeks ago, investors were doubtful that it would cut again at its December 9th and 10th meeting, but that changed after key officials signaled that they would support another move. Yields on treasuries largely reflect investors' expectations for what short-term rates set by the Fed will average over the life of a bond. With those rates already below 4%, many have argued that it was only a matter of time before yields on 10-year treasuries also dropped below that threshold. In Japan, the central bank has been slowly moving toward tighter monetary policies in the face of sticky inflation. The Bank of Japan first raised rates out of negative territory in early 2024 and has lifted rates twice since then, the last time in January. Japan's finance ministry also recently said it plans to boost government bond issuance to fund an economic stimulus package, putting further upward pressure on bond yields. Some analysts have questioned whether the Bank of Japan would raise rates now, at a time when new Prime Minister Sane Takaichi is trying to boost the economy. But many were revising their views after Governor Ueda said that the Bank of Japan would thoroughly discuss the possibility of a rate increase at its next meeting. Ueda said that the country's economic outlook had improved after Tokyo's recent trade agreement with the Trump administration. Uncertainties surrounding U.S. tariff policy and the U.S. economy, which we had been particularly monitoring, have significantly declined compared to a few months ago, he said, at a news conference in Nagoya on Monday. And that's prospect of Japan rate rise rattles investors. Next, we have Netflix sweetens bid for Warner Discovery. This is by Joe Flint, Lauren Thomas, and Dave Michaels. Netflix has sweetened its offer for Warner Bros. Discovery in a second round of bids as it tries to outdo rival Paramount. The streamer on Monday made a primarily cash-based second offer for the entertainment and streaming assets of Warner Discovery and is working to secure tens of billions of dollars in financing to fund the purchase, people familiar with the matter said. Paramount also made an improved offer for all of Warner Discovery, including its collection of cable networks like CNN and TNT, some of the people said. Comcast Corporation, parent of NBC Universal, has submitted a second bid for the entertainment assets as well, a person with knowledge of that situation said. Like Netflix, Comcast is interested in the studios and streaming service, not the cable channels. The terms of Paramount and Comcast's new offers couldn't be learned. It is unclear whether there will be another round of bids. The parties are waiting to hear back from Warner Discovery. Warner Discovery essentially put itself up for sale in October after receiving several unsolicited offers from Paramount, which Warner Discovery rebuffed. Paramount is run by Chief Executive Officer David Ellison. Ellison's family, including his billionaire father, Larry Ellison, is backing the bid with help from private equity firm Redbird Capital Partners. Warner Discovery has indicated it would like to wrap up its auction process by around Christmas. It's also continuing with plans to split itself into two separate companies, one comprising the studio and streaming assets, and the other containing its global cable network operations. A potential acquisition by Netflix of the Warner Brothers TV and movie studios, their vast libraries of content, and the HBO Max streaming service might face scrutiny from lawmakers and regulators. Some officials at the Justice Department are concerned that Netflix owning HBO Max would give it too much power in the streaming marketplace, a person familiar with their thinking said. The department's antitrust division, which is responsible for reviewing deals, hasn't formally evaluated a potential transaction. There was also a recent meeting of high-level White House officials in which concerns about a Netflix Warner Discovery deal were discussed, according to people familiar with the matter. The New York Post previously reported on the White House meeting. Bloomberg reported on the details of Netflix's latest bid. Netflix is the biggest subscription streaming service in the U.S. However, it is sixth in total TV usage ranked by parent company, coming in behind Google's YouTube, Comcast, Paramount, and others, according to Nielsen. Other suitors could also face scrutiny. Paramount and Comcast already own large movie and television production units, and either one combining with Warner Discovery would create a behemoth. And that's Netflix Sweden's bid for Warner Discovery. Next, we have meet the CEO behind the world's fastest growing defense company. This is by Alistair MacDonald, Christina Gallardo, and Bertrand Benoit. Earlier this year, Armin Papiger opened a new factory that will allow his company to produce more of an essential caliber of artillery shell than the entire U.S. defense industry combined. Surrounded that day by dignitaries, including the head of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the Rheinmetall chief executive was riding a wave of post-Cold War military spending that's reshaping the global arms trade. Rheinmetall is now the world's fastest growing large defense company and a key player in Europe's quest to rearm. Its home country, Germany, is shedding its post-war reticence on military spending to lead the charge. To capitalize, Papiger has pushed the once obscure gun barrel maker into almost every part of the battlefield, from satellites to warships. His goal? To create a go-to defense company with the heft and breadth to rival the American giants that have dominated the industry since World War II. Rheinmetall's stock is up about 15 times since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, giving it a market value of about $80 billion. Roughly on par with U.S. rivals, compared with just $1.6 billion when Papiger took the helm in 2013. Last month, Rheinmetall set out ambitions to quintuple sales by the end of the decade to roughly the equivalent of $58 billion. Papiger, reflecting on his long tenure at the company, told investors that seeing such figures was like a wonder world. Hitting that target won't be easy. The 62-year-old engineer must now integrate a fast empire that stretches into new areas where he lacks expertise. Rheinmetall's lofty valuation is also partly driven by plans that have yet to materialize. The company's stock has fallen since a peace plan for Ukraine emerged, underscoring its speedy rise and potentially fragile foundations. Meanwhile, Papiger's assertive style has irked officials and some U.S. executives who've joined with the German business as a way to tap the booming European market. "They come to me," Papiger said of U.S. companies in an interview. 10 years ago, it was a different story. In a more ominous sign of Papiger's newfound status, he was flanked that day by two armed undercover guards who have stayed close to the executive side ever since the U.S. warned last year that Russia planned to assassinate him. Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine, combined with pressure from President Trump to increase military budgets, has opened the spigots on European military spending. This year, the region is set to spend more than $560 billion on defense, according to analysts at Bernstein, double what it spent a decade ago. Papiger moved to quickly capitalize, agreeing to buy an artillery shell maker in 2022, just as demand for the ammunition skyrocketed amid the war. Since then, he's kicked Rheinmetall into overdrive. The company has recently built four factories and is rushing to construct more than a dozen more to churn out everything from ammunition to drones and armored vehicles. The recently opened shell factory based in northern Germany was completed in just 15 months. By contrast, Britain's BAE Systems has yet to open an extension to an existing shell factory that it announced in early 2022. Papiger has bought a naval shipyard, established a joint venture to develop satellites, and invested in drone makers. He has also expanded into the U.S. In just 3 years, Papiger has built a business with the breadth of what was assembled over the course of around a century to create BAE Systems, its nearest European rival. Rheinmetall increased capacity on a scale that no other large defense company did, just as demand massively outstripped supply, said Adrian Rebier, an analyst at Bernstein. He's the only one who's made all the right decisions, and he's the reason why Rheinmetall is the hottest stock in Europe, Rebier said. The rising profile of the company and its CEO was evident at a recent arms fair in London. Rheinmetall showed off an array of combat vehicles, drones, and munitions while a throng of executives, military chiefs, and defense ministers lined up to talk to Papiger. Some industry peers say Papiger is moving too fast. It's my personal opinion that the stretch from welding steel to drying powder to state-of-the-art software architectures is too big. No company can cope with that, Oliver Dore, CEO of German radar maker Hensoldt, recently told reporters. Others in the industry privately voice incredulity at what has become a whirlwind of announcements from Rheinmetall on new contracts, joint ventures, and other deals. Some of the company's plans have yet to come to fruition. In 2023, Papiger said, Rheinmetall would set up a factory in Ukraine capable of churning out 400 new tanks a year. More than 2 years later, work is yet to begin. A mooted Ukrainian shell factory also has yet to materialize. Papiger said Ukraine didn't make the orders and investment needed to start production. To hit its growth target, Rheinmetall will need to keep winning government orders and make deals with other companies. But Papiger's willingness to publicly comment on negotiations and his assertive style have irritated officials in Germany, his largest client, according to people familiar with the matter. On at least one occasion, government officials reminded Papiger about the classified nature of their negotiations, one of the people said. A Rheinmetall spokesman said the company has an excellent relationship with the German government and complies with all regulations on confidentiality. Papiger has also irked executives at U.S. companies. Rheinmetall and Lockheed Martin are negotiating a joint venture that will produce American missiles in Europe. A deal would alleviate a shortage in Europe and allow the U.S. company to grab a greater share of the region's swelling budgets. On a May earnings call, Papiger predicted that the venture would start producing long-range Army Tactical Missile Systems, or ATACMS, within 12 to 13 months, among other times he has detailed plans. However, such production hasn't yet been agreed on by either Lockheed or the Pentagon, causing frustration among some executives at the U.S. company, according to people familiar with the matter. And that's Meet the CEO behind the world's fastest growing defense company. We're going to turn now to the Heard on the Street section. And for this final article, are you sure that's a growth stock? Berkshire Hathaway is a growth stock. How do we know? The people who put together the S&P 500 Growth Index stuck it in there. It's also in the S&P 500 Value Index with a somewhat higher weighting. A stock that isn't in that group of supposedly fast-growing companies, surging chipmaker Advanced Micro Devices, which trades at 140 times trailing earnings. It's only in the value index. Someone buying an S&P 500 value fund gets about three quarters as much exposure to it as to the much larger conglomerate run by legendary value investor Warren Buffett. It's hard to say which is weirder, that or the fact that the two S&P 500 indexes have 612 stocks between them. Its overlap isn't unique. Small capitalization Russell 2000 growth and value index funds have 2,518 stocks in total. With close to one quarter of the money invested in U.S. stocks following a style index, the way they're constructed can do more than confuse investors. It might be costing them. A stock company certainly can tick both boxes. Growth at a reasonable price, or GARP, has been a winning strategy. What if they're neither? Index developer Research Affiliates looked at the top 1,000 U.S. stocks since 1970, dividing them into its own growth and value categories. Then it split that into quadrants, companies that ticked 2, 1, or 0 boxes. A basket of the stocks in the cheap, fast-growing quadrant beat the top 1,000 stocks alone by 0.8 percentage point a year. The slow, expensive quadrant trailed by 2 points annually. Since they fit neither description, excluding them would both make sense and boost returns. But that isn't how popular style indexes work. Every stock gets included in one category and sometimes both, like Berkshire. Their style weights must add up to their full index weight, so nothing is too expensive or too slow growing to make the cut. That isn't the only problem, according to Research Affiliates chairman Robert Arnott. Traditional capitalization-weighted products like S&P 500 index funds are efficient, but individual companies' weights are set by their prices rather than traits like how fast sales are expected to rise. Frothy does not equal growth. Growth equals growth, says Arnott, a pioneer of so-called fundamental index funds that weight companies by their business qualities instead. An investor fretting over the dominance of the Magnificent Seven stocks these days might swap their S&P 500 fund for a more conservative value index fund. Bolder souls might opt for a growth fund. According to the study's authors, either move might be more diversification than diversification. This item by Spencer Jacob, Are You Sure That's a Growth Stock? You've been listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Thank you for joining me for this Tuesday edition, and remember you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming either as it streams or at a time of your choosing by going to sunsounds.org, the Sun Sounds of Arizona website, or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app from the Apple App Store for your iPhone or iPad, or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And finally, you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot Echo or Show.